In Luke chapter 9 is where we're, the task is where I'm going to be. That's the passage. We're getting closer to this magnificent Sunday that is really the center of our Christian faith. Without the resurrection of Jesus, truthfully, Christianity has no real meaning. And so without Resurrection Sunday, that's kind of the center of our faith. It's the focus. We talk about his death on the cross. That's absolutely true. It's absolutely a very vital part. It just didn't end there. He ended and finished his job of providing us salvation, but on the cross. But his resurrection is what really finished, I think, the story for us. Yeah, I don't know what the noise is. I think it's the clock, but I'm not sure. I'm going to use the next few weeks to consider some scenes, just a couple of them, because there's only a few weeks to go, of the journey that Jesus makes to Jerusalem. Okay, we're going to take a look at some less known scenes, I'm going to call it. I tried to pick out some things that would be something we haven't talked about a lot. His journey to Jerusalem is the very purpose of his life on earth. And it was soon to take place when he set his mind to go. I've always wondered, when did Jesus know? When did he finally realize this was the reason I'm here? I know at 12 years old when he was asking questions of the teachers there in the temple, and he was asking some very mature questions, and they were absolutely astonished at the questions and the way he was listening to what they were having to say. It was clear that he knew who his father was. That part was clear. And I think that Joseph and Mary had a hand in teaching him that and making that clear and telling him his story of his life. But I wonder, when did Jesus actually know as a human? I know he knew before and all that. But you understand what I'm saying? I guess he was clearly aware. There was no doubt that he was aware that his purpose was to bring salvation to the world. And he clearly knew that this included death on a cross, which could not have been a good feeling at all, because that's one of the worst ways that ever devised by humans to inflict on another human. Early in his ministry, Jesus told Nicodemus, you might remember this, that the Son of Man would be lifted up. And he, that's in John 3:14, and he mentions, like Moses lifted the serpent in the wilderness, and you can go back and look at that story. In Luke, before we get to our passage, we find two places where Jesus told the disciples of his impending death. He was very clear about it. The first one is Luke 9, 21 and 22. Now, what's interesting about this particular passage, 21 and 22, is that it comes after he fed 5,000 men and women and children. We know there were more, right? And he also, this is after Peter makes a confession in chapter 9, verse 20, that Jesus is God's Messiah. So this is good stuff. This is good news. He's done something really wonderful. Now I want you to read verses 21 and 22 with me in chapter 9. But Jesus strictly warned and instructed them to tell this to no one, saying, it is necessary that the Son of Man suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and scribes, be killed, and be raised on the third day. So he's very clear with the disciples. Now, what's fascinating, I guess, out of it was that two things. He didn't refute Peter's confession that he was God's Messiah. He didn't say, no, you're wrong. He just said, don't tell anyone. Why? Because it wasn't time yet. It wasn't time for the world to know this at this time. And so, but he clearly lays out what's about to happen. He's going to be rejected. He's going to be killed. He's going to be raised on the third day. And what's amazing to me is that it seems that the disciples didn't hear that. They didn't hear him say that. They may have heard he was going to be rejected, and they kind of were like, well, yeah, that's been happening already. But they didn't hear that he would be killed and then raised on the third day. That would have raised a whole bunch of questions normally, wouldn't you think? Luke 9:28 says it was 8 days after this conversation, and then Jesus teaches, does a teaching about what it's going to cost to follow him, the cost of following him, and what that, you know, what that all means and so forth. And it says after this, he took Peter, John, and James up on the mountain to pray. It's one of the few times in the Bible that names them as John and James, because, you know, James was the older, John was the baby of the family, apparently. And it's just interesting that he takes them up on the mountain, remember, to pray. And what happens then is the transfiguration of Jesus. Remember that story? I know you do. I know you. If you don't, it's right there in chapter 9, okay? It starts about 28, I think it is. This transfiguration, they get to see Jesus not only transfigured into probably his glorified form, but they get to see Moses and Elijah. I still have the same question. How did they know? Anybody? I've got an echo, Brenda. Can you take my volume down just a little bit? It's on the left side up there. Please. I've got an echo. It's driving me crazy. And there's a clicking going on. I don't know what that is. Thank you. The answer is I don't know. The only thing I can ever figure out is that Jesus may have addressed them as Elijah and as Moses. He may have called them by name, and that's how the disciples know. Except that the problem is that according to one of the accounts, they fell asleep. So I don't know how they knew, but they knew. And Luke learned it by talking with them, of course, and that's why he puts it in there. I think it's interesting. It says that Peter wanted to set up three shelters to honor Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. In other words, three altars, essentially. And he's equating them as together. Luke says Peter didn't know what he was saying. Well, obviously not. If he's equating these three together, then no, Jesus is way above Elijah and Moses. And they would agree, by the way, I have no doubt. Remember, Luke is writing after all this. He's writing his book after all this has happened, all the way through the rejection, the killing, the resurrection, the ascension. He's writing his book, his gospel account after. So he knows that Peter didn't know what he was saying. Well, no, he didn't. And Luke recognizes this. Now, God speaks to the three disciples during this event, this transfiguration. You might remember that too. A cloud overcomes them and all this, and they were kind of a little nervous anyway. And then God speaks to them and he says, "This is my son, the chosen one." You might have it as the beloved. Listen to him. That's in Luke 9:35. It's very clear. If you take a look at verse 36, would you? I didn't put it on the screen, but just take a look at 9:36. After the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. They, meaning the disciples, the three disciples, kept silent and at that time told no one what they had seen. They were so surprised, so struck, so overwhelmed, they didn't even talk to each other. And, you know, for Peter, come on, let's face it, we know that was pretty amazing. And for James and John, that's pretty amazing as well, if you know anything about them. So they come off the mountain the next day, it says, to face a large crowd. The other nine disciples were waiting down there at the bottom of the mountain, and they had been unable to drive out a demon out of that was possessing a little boy. And so Jesus exercised his power over that demon by rebuking it and healing the little boy, all right? And what's exciting to me about the story is that the people were all astonished at the greatness of God. They were overwhelmed by that. They were surprised, I think, in some ways. And so this is good. This is a wonderful thing. They recognized God's hand in the healing of this little boy. While the people were, I guess, getting excited about this and talking to each other, Jesus spoke to his disciples. Take a look with me at verse 43. through 45. And they were all astonished at the greatness of God. And while everyone was amazed at all the things he was doing, he told his disciples, let these words sink in. The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. But they did not understand this statement. It was concealed from them, so they could not grasp it. And they were afraid to ask him about it. Now, I'm not sure why they were afraid to ask Jesus. I think sometimes the disciples had a feeling that they were supposed to know already. I think that was part of it. And the second thing is that sometimes you just get an impression that Jesus was not always happy when they ask questions about it. It just said they were afraid to ask him. So I don't really know all of that. Luke says they didn't understand his words because the meaning was concealed from them. Okay. But Matthew says they were deeply distressed. His account, Matthew's account in 17, chapter 17 of the same story, by the way, they were deeply distressed. Now, I have no doubt that it was both. I think it was concealed from them, and they were deeply distressed probably because of that. And this concern about asking Jesus, it just, I don't know, I'm not sure I understand fully why, but I guess there was a reason if they were walking with him. It seems strange that the 12 responded as they did to this announcement about the cross. Instead of asking him about it or suddenly realizing, wait a minute, he's telling us he's going to die. What in the world is this all about? And didn't he just tell us he was also going to be raised on the third day? We need to know a little bit more about this. Instead of this humility and recognizing this, they started arguing over who was the greatest disciple. Now, we can shake our heads at them and, you know, how dare you? We can do all that. We have no business doing all that, by the way, because I've seen it in myself. I've seen it all around me. It's very common. It's a combination, I think, of the nine who failed to cast out the demon. They already are feeling a little bit antsy about that. And then I think the three that have come off the mountain, they have the privilege of going up there and getting to see something really cool and wonderful and amazing and overwhelming, and they're not telling the other nine about it. And I'm sure that's not going over well. And so, yeah, they start arguing over who's the greatest. There was a rivalry among these men. Don't you think Peter, James, and John would love telling the nine what they saw on the mountain? You know they would. You know they would like to do it, but unfortunately I'm afraid they would like to do it by rubbing it in. Right? Matthew says in 17:9 that Jesus told them to be quiet. In other words, he told them, don't tell anybody. He told them that in Luke too. Don't say anything. I think what happened is the 12 were walking in the flesh. Galatians 5:20 kind of gives you a description of that if you ever want to take a look at that. That's Paul's description of it. And I think they were only thinking of themselves. You know, the nine, they couldn't throw out the demon and they were just beating themselves up about it, which they didn't need to because Jesus told them later why. Anyway, and for the three that were on the mountain, they were about to burst with this incredible experience that they had that they weren't supposed to talk about. Jesus had this in mind. They had to learn to love one another. If they were going to serve Jesus successfully, effectively, properly, they had to learn to love one another. Now they could all, I bet every one of them would tell you that they loved them. They loved each other. You know they would. They would say, well, of course. But what does that mean? What did Jesus mean by love one another? Well, that's a whole message in itself, but Jesus gave him an example down here in that section there. He brings a little child that's nearby. I guess it's from the crowd, right? And has the child stand next to him, and he teaches to try to teach the disciples what was missing. And take a look at verse 48, would you? 9:48. Here it goes. He told them, whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. Now, it sounds like, well, that's easy. Who wouldn't welcome a little child, right? But are you welcoming that child as equal to you? Or are you welcoming that child because, well, I'm older, I'm smarter than you, and I'm going to teach you? And whoever welcomes me, now he's equated this little child, welcoming the child is welcoming him, right? And whoever welcomes me welcomes him who sent me. And then this is for all of you that drive this way. For whoever is least among you, this one is great. You're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. You're in a long line. Who goes first? The one at the end of the line always goes first, right? They always run up to get to the first of the line. If you're at the first of the line, just stay there. If you're at the back of the line, just stay there. It'll open up. It'll become a two-lane eventually. Don't worry. Okay? You know what I'm talking about. Jesus is trying to let them know. He's trying to explain to them that they have to love one another by accepting that they're all equal. They're not the same, no. Everybody has their own skills and abilities and thoughts and all that sort of stuff. But before God, at the foot of the cross, we're all equal. We're all sinners. We all need Jesus. It appears that the 12 also had to learn how to love others who were not part of their special group. There's one last section I want to get to before we get to the main passage. I know it sounds like I'm taking a long ride to get here, but I wanted you to completely hear the context before we get to the point where Jesus says, okay, it's time for me to go to Jerusalem. Take a look at verses 49 and 50. It just seems that they had to learn something very important. Verse 49, John responded, Master, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he does not follow us. Think about that for a moment. Not just the demon part. Think about the first two words. John responded. Jesus has just told them, for whoever is least among you, this one is great. This child, if you accept this child, you're accepting me. If you're accepting me, you're accepting the one who sent me. John responds, Master, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he doesn't follow us. I'm not even there, and I've got a headache. Don't stop him, Jesus told him, because whoever is not against you is for you. When I was a child, I remember asking my dad, why are there so many different kinds of churches? And why are there so many different kinds of cars? I was watching cars, you know, I had the privilege of sitting in the front seat and I could see cars going by, and there's Fords and Chevys and I can't even remember all the models that were back there. And I remember passing several churches on the way as we were going to ours. We went to a Methodist church at the time before they were United Methodist and before they kind of went crazy. But anyway, I remember that we passed a Baptist, we passed a Catholic, and over here was another one. And I said, why are there so many different kinds? I don't understand. And I remember my dad's words, and he said simply, because there are so many different kinds of people. Everybody has different tastes. And so some people like Fords, and some people like Chevys, and some people like Dodge Rams, and some people like, you know, different kinds of vehicles. And so it's okay. It's okay. Whichever one you like, it's fine. And when it comes to the churches, he said there's so many different kinds of churches, again, because there's so many different kinds of people, and people have a different understanding of Scripture. Now, I have to give my dad credit here and kudos, because he also reminded me of what Paul said, which was that if the gospel of Christ is being preached, it's okay where they're doing it. It's okay. Some of them do it with fancy ceremonies, and some of them are like Baptists. We're totally disorganized, do it our own way, and it's okay. It's fine. as long as the gospel is being preached. What I love is what Jesus said. Don't stop him, because whoever is not against you is for you. Now, it could also be translated, whoever is not against us is for us. Okay? Some translations say it that way. So would you keep that in mind? And let's don't look down our noses at other churches or other denominations or whatever. Now, I don't want to get into that right now, but I just want to say that if the gospel is being preached, we have Jesus telling us it's okay. Got to remember that when Jesus is telling them this, he had more than 12 disciples. He actually did. He had more than 12 men he was going to send out. He had 70 other men that he would and could eventually would send out in service, and that's in Luke 10, if you ever want to read about that, where he sends 70 out, and it's pretty exciting what they get to do. John thought he was being spiritual, no doubt about it, by forbidding this anonymous man from serving in some way, casting out demons. But Jesus lovingly rebuked him to let him know, if he's for me, then he's not against me. If he's not against me, then he's for me. So, you know, let it go. So I wanted you to hear all of that. That's the context. It kind of leads us up to verse 51. Let's read it again. We're going to read it again. I know we read it already. I got to tell you, I think the Lord was probably exhausted by this time, dealing not only with the disciples, but dealing with the crowds and the people who demanded so much of him. But it's important, again, I want you to, I need to repeat this. It is important to remember, Jesus knows he must go to Jerusalem in order to complete his task, his mission, his goal of salvation for the world. His constant prayers to the Father, he prayed all the time for direction, I think have been answered. When he became absolutely sure and knew exactly when it was, I don't know. It's not specified in Scripture, but at some point he just began to realize that. And he has followed his Father in all things. In fact, he even made a comment one time that he did nothing and said nothing without the Father's direction. That's pretty extraordinary. Would you like to live that way? Would you like to live that way? To know that everything that you said and everything you did, everything you thought was by the direction of God the Father? Whew. All right, let's read Luke 9, 51 to 56. I know we've read it, but I want to read it again. When the days were coming to a close for him to be taken up, he determined, he set his face to journey to Jerusalem. He sent messengers ahead of himself, and on the way they entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But they did not welcome him because he determined to journey to Jerusalem. When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to consume them? Again, it may say in your translation, as Elijah did. But he turned and rebuked them. And there's a phrase, I'll bring that up in a few minutes. And they went to another village. Verse 51 reports that Jesus recognized the days were coming to a close for him to be taken up. Time was coming. He knew it was there. And it also said that he determined to journey to Jerusalem. And I wanted you to hear the literal reading in the Greek is Jesus stiffened his face to go to Jerusalem. And you can almost imagine he just sat and said, okay, it's time to go. He just set his face. Every one of us have done that when we've gone on a journey. We have a moment when we just stiffen our face and say, okay, we're on our way. We're going. Luke is reminding, I think, readers of possibly of Isaiah 50, verse 7, which is when the prophet said that he had set his face like flint against his tormentors in service to the Lord God. Now, the Apologetic Study Bible notes that the section that starts here at 9:51, verse 51, all the way through chapter 19, verse 44, is called the travel narrative because it roughly outlines the final journey of Jesus' trip. And the same scholars that wrote that also note that Luke's narrative is only broadly chronological. It's not a day-by-day dissertation. And that may explain, if you've ever compared Luke and Matthew and Mark, if you ever do the comparison thing, you might see some differences that could explain why there are differences. There's also three different witnesses. Remember that as well. Some scholars also note that it's possible that Jesus repeated some of these teachings multiple times, and so that they may have shown up at different times in his journey. I'm going to try to stay in the book of Luke all the way through Resurrection Sunday as much as possible to give his account what we're going to look at this year, okay? The 12 had to learn to love one another. They had to love others who were not part of their special group. And finally, they had to learn to love their enemies. That's one of the biggest things that Jesus taught us. Remember about loving others? We're supposed to love one another as he first loved us. We're supposed to love our neighbors. That's all easy stuff. We can do that easy peasy. But when you say, I got to love my enemies, okay, now we have a problem, Lord. What am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? You got to remember the Samaritans and the Jews had been feuding, that's a nice way of putting it, for centuries. They had been fighting for a long time. But Jesus refused to take part in this fight. He wasn't gonna be part of this. Remember John chapter 4? This is the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman. That's a good indicator of how he wasn't going to take part in this. You might remember Luke 10, 25 to 37, the famous parable and wonderful parable of the Good Samaritan. I love teaching this. And Brother Dennis, I don't know if I'm sure you had the same problem I do, is how do I convince modern-day Americans, modern-day Christians, that the Good Samaritan was not necessarily a good guy as far as the Jewish listeners were concerned? When Jesus taught that parable, that Samaritan was like, what? So anyway, that's another day. It has a different connotation than it did when he answered the question. You remember he answered the question, who's my neighbor? That was what started that's why he taught that parable. And it's a wonderful story of a man, of a Samaritan who rescued a man who was beaten and robbed. Now Luke 9:52 says that Jesus sent messengers ahead, and this was to prepare a place for them to stay so that he and his disciples could stay as their journey continued, because they're going to go south through Samaria and then on into Judea and all that. And the messengers, when they arrived, it says a village of Samaritans. It doesn't say what village, but because of this constant feud, and it was part of the feud was where do they worship? They have a temple in Jerusalem, and they had the big altar place up in Samaria, and I can't remember, Shiloh, I think, or one of those places, might even have been Samaria. Anyway, they had a town up there, and that's where they believed you're supposed to worship. And there's a whole long story why they were fighting. But the people of that village refused to welcome Jesus because he's making this journey to Jerusalem. He's going to Jerusalem to worship. What is he thinking? We've got a perfectly good place here for him to worship. He should stay here. In part of the story, it might take a moment to remind you that John is also known as the Apostle of Love, if you've not known that. That's because God is love is found in his gospel account. But Jesus called him and his brother James the sons of thunder, according to Mark 3:17. And Luke 9:54 provides a bit of clarity to that title, why Jesus gave him that title. Maybe it was seeing Elijah on the mountain of transfiguration. Maybe that's what incited James and John to say, hey, we want to call fire down from heaven. I put the reference 2 Kings chapter 1. That's where the story of Elijah, because there's some manuscripts include the words, as Elijah also did. I just love the fact not only that they wanted to do that, okay, because have you ever wanted to call down fire? Okay, am I the only one? but I love their confidence. Not only that they wanted to, but they really believed that they could do so. But they asked Jesus, is it okay if we do that? I'm glad they did. I'm glad they asked, because otherwise that town might have been destroyed and then there was a mess, okay, right? That would be a mess. You have to read 2 Kings to find out that whole story if you've forgotten it. And of course, this is not the way you turn an enemy into a friend. Romans 12, Paul talks about that, how you deal with an enemy and how you turn them into a friend. And incidentally, it works. Exactly the way he describes it. It works. Not every enemy will become your friend, but more of them than not. Okay? I'll let you look up Romans 12 and take a look at that. Jesus made it very clear that their request was not welcomed. And some manuscripts in verse, 55, when he says he turned and rebuked them, also adds this phrase, you don't know what kind of spirit you belong to, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy people's lives, but to save them. Hey, nuts, if you go and destroy this village, how in the world can I save them? You've destroyed them. That's not going to work. You understand why I said I thought he was probably tired by this time. All through all of this, Jesus never forgot his mission. He never forgot why he was here. He was here to save the world. He was born in a small town of Bethlehem, raised by a carpenter and his wife. The Lord Jesus, now, we are in the storyline, we are now at a place where he is set on this final journey, this final trip to Jerusalem. He's going to complete his task there of providing salvation to the world once for all. And that's what we're going to be talking about over the next few weeks. We'll talk about it on God's Friday. We'll talk about it on Sunday morning. Because all of that matters when we're talking to anyone outside the church. Even if we're talking to each other. But if we're talking to someone outside the church especially who's not involved in a church, who's not involved and doesn't even have any idea what you're even talking about, this is the story we need to bring. Okay? This is part of it, part of that story. That's my invitation this morning, to follow Jesus forever, wherever he leads you, wherever he takes you.